The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with an interesting first person. A Life in Buttons. Bought at auction, a vintage cookie tin opens a window into neighbor's secreted heart. And there's a picture here, it's a cartoon drawing of a cookie tin, a round cookie tin, stuffed solid with buttons of all different shapes, sizes, and colors. Going, going, gone for $3 to bidder number 43, the lady in the last row in the white hat. The auctioneer called out my auction number and location. I had just won the bidding for a 1950s cookie tin full of memories at an estate sale outside in McConnellsburg, Pennsylvania, near the farm where my husband and I live. Delighted at my victory, I took the box and gave it a shake. The contents rattled. I pried off the lid and took a peek. Inside were dozens, maybe even hundreds, of buttons, pins, and other items, all glittering in the sunlight. It reminded me of my mom's button box. As a girl, I'd always enjoyed digging through it, just as my own daughters enjoyed looking through mine. I listened to the auctioneer's patter as more objects were bid on and sold. I bought some lovely embroidered pillowcases and a few other things. Soon my eye caught the movement of a swing on the front porch of the house. A petite older woman watched the happenings in her yard, her eyes wandering over the crowd, looking for the familiar faces of friends and neighbors. As I carried my purchases to my car, I stopped to chat with her. We made small talk about the large number of people that had gathered and the prices her things were bringing. She told me she was selling almost all her possessions because she was moving to a nursing home in town. Her eyes fell to the button box, and when she looked up, they were glistening with tears. I asked whether she minded if I sat with her a while. She slid over to make room for me on her swing. I took the lid off the tin. Her gnarled hand lifted the handful of buttons and then slowly dropped them back into the container. Her fist closed around a delicate pearl button, now yellow with age. She smiled as she told me about the birth of her first child and the special pearl button christening outfit that would be worn by 5 more babies before the time wore the garment thin. I noticed a large, dark brass military button and asked her about it. "From my first husband's uniform," she said. "It's one of the few things I had to remind me of him when he didn't return home alive." They had been married 7 months before he left to serve his country in World War II. "I married his best friend 2 years later, and we had a good marriage," she told me. "That's the way it was in those days. Some of us always looked out for the widows and children." We sifted through the box together. We found hairpins ranging from black to brown, in shades of gray and even white. Each color noted the passing of time and its effect on her hair. When I pulled a small key from the box, I heard a sharp intake of breath. It was the key to a music box that had played a special love song, she said. She'd lost it years ago. From my hand to hers, I passed the key to her memories. "We found a Sunday school pen holding a bar for perfect attendance in every year except one," she explained. "The year my mother was sick with cancer, I stayed home on Sundays with her so my father could get to go to church. He never missed a Sunday until he died 15 years ago." Garter clips, wooden nickels, snaps, and ruby buttons took her further down memory lane. I learned about her wedding, the birth of her children, and much more of the life she led for 89 years. After our chat, I set the woman's box of memory down on the swing and slid my hands into hers. I knew we would talk again when I went to visit her at her new home, and I knew that when I reached my own home, my heart would pull me to my sewing room, where I would rediscover my own lifetime of memories in my own button box. Maybe we should change their names, because they have an odd number of body segments. Centipedes are never born with exactly 100 legs. Starfish, cuttlefish, and jellyfish are not actually fish. The only thing they have in common with fish is their habitat. The mountain chicken is a frog, and it lives in the Caribbean. The Power of Family. This year, we ask readers a question. When you think of family, what's the image you see? The winning submissions and the stories behind them were all universal and remarkably moving. And there's a gentleman in a uniform standing here with a small baby in his pocket. And it's a military uniform, if you're not familiar with them, have huge pockets to stick all stuff in. It's the first time I've ever seen a baby in one, though. And this is the grand prize, Daddy's Girl, Christina DeCamp. This is Sergeant John R. Christian and our 5-day-old firstborn, whom he had to leave behind when she was 6 months old for his third deployment as an Army canine bobdog handler. Despite his being gone for most of her first year and not reuniting with her until she was 8 months old, 18 months old, they are absolutely best friends, forever a daddy's girl. That's from Katie Christian, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Big brotherly love. It shows two young boys walking down the a sidewalk. One of them has a yellow, they both have football uniforms. One of them has it on, the other has his pads and his shoulder pads in his hand. Honorable mention. Colby and Blake's teams had lost their games that day. Colby left was taking it hard, so Blake was reminding him of what he'd done well. Brothers may argue and fight at times, but when the chips are down, big brothers are always close by. Dorothy Pelletier, Taylor, South Carolina. And there's a picture of an African-American family. And the gentleman has glasses, and he's reaching over and kissing a little girl. And his wife is on the other side of the little girl, kissing her cheek as well. And in his arms and in her hand is an infant. Beautiful picture. Witnessing the beginning. This is also a runner-up. I was hired to photograph the Charles family in Cranford, New Jersey, a few days after baby Niam was born home. Just before I took this shot, Kiernan, the older son, oh, I guess it's a boy, was jumping on the bed behind his parents. His hair was long. I thought it was a little girl. My apologies, Kieran. So I suggested he go hug his mom and dad. Within seconds, he leaped right between them, and they each kissed him on the cheek as they held Niam in their arms. Just like that, their new family of four came together to express their utmost happiness in all its security and warmth. What a beautiful picture. Just gorgeous. A pair of hands, an older lady's hands. It looks like it might be it's interesting. Her left hand is not is older looking than her right hand. But both of them have rings on their ring fingers, and they're holding on top of a Bible. The Good Book. This is also a runner-up. This is a photograph of my mother's hands on top of her Bible. I took this photo on the morning of my older brother's funeral service on June 1st, 2017, in Van Buren, Arkansas. It was the first time I'd been home in over 10 years. My mother was sitting alone on the front porch and looking through the Bible for a specific psalm to be read during the service. The ring with the pink ice gemstone had just arrived that morning. It was a late Mother's Day present from my brother had mailed to her. And it's a beautiful ring. It looks like Princess Di's ring, except with a pink stone. Oh, how tragic is that? Endless love. And an older couple standing on the beach. Both of them have their pants rolled up to their knees, and they're smooching. We didn't have a lot, but Skipper and Hutter, Dad and Mom, put all six of us and our dog, Rex, in the station wagon and drive an hour to the beach in Belmar, New Jersey. Mom had Alzheimer's and Dad had cancer here. This was their last trip. So grateful to have the memories. Michael Hamilton from Belleville, New Jersey. And the next picture is a little boy, blonde hair, big smile, laughing like crazy, holding a hose with the nozzle pointed straight up and he's squeezing the trigger, and his dad is kneeling down next to him, laughing with him and helping him hold the hose. Having a blast. Honorable mention. My brother, old Roger, and his grandson, Quinn, were out in the yard playing with the hose and having so much fun. I grabbed my camera, went around the house, and caught this moment. Every time I look at it, I have to smile. I do, too. It's a smiley picture. The family homestead. My grandpa, and it's a picture of a house that's basically collapsing. It's the sides are sagging, the roof has a huge hole, but it's an old style farmhouse with the kitchen aspect strapped to the back. But interesting enough, I don't see a chimney. My grandpa grew up in this old house in southern Oklahoma. I would listen to him tell stories of pulling cotton and plowing the fields before the sun came up. I could still see him standing in the doorway, leaning against the door frame with a toothpick in his mouth. Even though we've lost some pieces over the years, the strength of the family is like this old homestead, leaned and cracking in some places, but still standing proudly through it all. The River of Peace. Oh, this is a beautiful picture. It's obviously a sunset, and there's a gentleman in the forefront throwing a, it looks like he's casting probably for trout, since it looks like a fly rod, and he's in the water up to his waist, but you can barely see the water because it's reflecting an orange and yellow and red sunset with the trees dark in the black. This is that beautiful time of evening when you can't make any details in the trees. All you can see are the shadows of the leaves. This is my dad fly fishing on the Penobscot River in Abbo Bridge Campground. My family has gone here for many years, starting when my grandparents were young. It's a place filled with many memories, including this one. To me, it summarizes the beauty and peacefulness of time spent together. Sarah Hanford from Sanford, Maine. And then we have a picture of a family. And, I mean, there are a lot of people here. There's a young man and a very beautiful young lady, an older man and a slightly older woman, another woman and two little boys. It looks like her probably husband behind him. And behind them is another young man and a woman and a little boy who's covering the older man's eyes. Say cheese and surprise. Get them all together. Get them to sit still for 2 minutes. Make them all look happy. Family picture day is a challenge. For this one, the photographer yelled, "Jenna's pregnant," to get our attention. She's the one in the green. She's laughing like crazy. And that's from George DeSirio, Coral Springs, Florida. Inspiration. Heroes of the virus. And there's two gentlemen sitting on the back of a pickup truck, both of them African-American, both of them very good-looking young men, muscular, strong-looking, with face masks hanging around the neck. And they have shirts on. One says 11.6. The other says, "Love Beyond Something, Your Organization." That's Terrence Lester on the right and Lecrae Moore on their Love Sinks in Motion. And they have sinks of some more. But these are heroes of the virus. As America continues to recover from the worst medical catastrophe of the past 100 years, one remarkable legacy will be the stories of the ordinary individuals who held us together. One hand washes the other. When public health officials started telling Americans that hand washing is one of the most powerful weapons against the spread of the coronavirus, Terrence Lester wondered, what about the homeless? Lester had been homeless himself for a time as a teenager, and today he runs a nonprofit in Atlanta called Beyond Walls that helps raise money for an awareness of homeless people. He knows all too well that in the best of times they are lucky to find a public bathroom that will let them in to wash up occasionally, not to mention several times a day. Lester's experience creating temporary shelters with his nonprofit led him to another idea, temporary hand-washing stations, the kind you see at outdoor music festivals. He mentioned the idea to his friend Lecrae Moore, a Grammy-winning Christian rapper, who eagerly donated enough money to buy 15 of the 150 washing stations. They called their project Love Sinks In. If leaders in the country are asking people to wash their hands, we also have to provide the tools to people living on the margins of society who are more prone to catch and spread the coronavirus, Lester says. After a success in Atlanta, the group sent sinks to Birmingham, Alabama, Oakland, California, Columbus, Ohio, and Austin, Texas, where a partner organization installed the sinks in parks and other public spaces, thanks to a $13,000 grant from Google. In addition to the startup funds, it cost about $500 a month to keep its sinks stocked with soap and clean water. One Atlanta hand washer, Sam, made sure his gratitude didn't go unnoticed. He left a note under the sink that said, "Thank you all for not forgetting about us." And then there's a picture of a porch that has a big teddy bear sitting on the porch looking out over the railing, and another one with a teddy bear sitting inside somewhere with big sunglasses and a bikini, and then another one leaning on a, looks like a railing of a wheelchair. Teddy bears to the rescue. Some of the most inspiring victims of the virus were the nation's schools. Education, friendships, recess, all put on hold, with parents filling in the gaps. Math class in the kitchen was hard, but managing the downtime was perhaps harder as the weather turned warmer and children everywhere hungered for fresh air and adventure. Enter the teddy bear hunt. One day, bears seemed to be hiding everywhere, staring out of windows in Iowa, tucked into portholes and porches in Maine, propped behind the steering wheels of parked cars in California. Some even turned up in New Zealand. Teddy bears can't walk on their own, of course. They got there with the help of people who hoped that spotting a furry friend or two would entertain the neighborhood children. It was a worldwide scavenger hunt. No one really knows where it started. though a 1989 children book, We're Going on a Bear Hunt, was clearly an inspiration. As it happens, the book's author, Michael Rosen, suspected he had contracted COVID-19. But to grateful parents, the real source didn't matter. To the parents, it's got to be a parent who came up with this idea. Thank you, one mom tweeted. Explaining to a four-year-old why playdates aren't allowed anymore is heartbreaking. So going on a bear hunt during our walks is the distraction we needed. The rent's on me. Clay Young could see the clouds gathering in late February. That was when Young, who owns more than 30 restored historical buildings in Jonesboro, Arkansas, got a call from one of his tenants, a restaurateur. Could Young hold off on cashing the next month's rent check for a while? Business was falling apart. Young quickly obliged, then wondered what would happen with the other five restaurants housed in his buildings. Even though he knew that he'd take a financial gut punch, Young called them all to say that April was going to be rent-free. Pay your employees and take care of your family, posted on Facebook. We'll get through this together. Young says he lost 20% of his total rent income that month, but the morale boost he gave the community and himself was worth every penny. I needed some good news, selfishly, he says. Before long, landlords around the country got the same idea. Blavid Plasek, who has 12 commercial and residential tenants in Montclair, New Jersey, gave them all a three-month rent holiday. Governor Phil Murphy was so impressed he gave Plasek a shout-out at a press conference. David exemplifies the spirit we need to see right now, of people stepping up to make sure others can come out of this emergency stronger. And so we all come out of this stronger, Murphy said. Hats off, David. Opening their hearts. It was the simplest of gestures, seeing people walking by his San Francisco apartment but unable to go outside himself. Nick Monroe took a bunch of colorful sticky notes and arranged them in the shape of a heart on his living room window. Half an hour later, the neighbors across the street responded with a sticky note heart of their own. Then another neighbor did the same. Then another. And another. Surprised and delighted, Monroe shared his block's emotional outpouring on Nextdoor.com. And within 2 days, people all across San Francisco had joined in. He even met his neighbors across the street for the first time. The hearts drew them onto their balconies, and a new friendship began. It's so weird to be separated from all these people, Monroe told Reader's Digest. Yet we're all in it together. A perfect delivery. Yanira Soriano arrived at the hospital with COVID-19, a severe case of pneumonia, and a baby due in less than a month. She was very scared. You could see in her eyes it was the most horrible thing, says Gina Mirza, M.D., the chief of neonatology at Southside Hospital in Bayshore, New York. With two lives hanging in the balance, the doctors knew they had to act immediately. Within hours, they put the 36-year-old Yamira on a ventilator. The next day, they put her in a medically induced coma in preparation for a cesarean section, but not before she extracted a pledge from the staff. She thought she was going to die, Nurse Ebony Marshall told WPIX-TV. She just asked us to promise to try to save her baby. And they did. Baby Walter was born happy and healthy on April 3rd, but his mother's condition was still dire. She remained on a ventilator. Then 11 days after entering the hospital, she improved enough to breathe on her own. The latest staff, now equal parts medical professional and surrogate godparents, could not contain their joy. When Yanira's husband, Walter Soriano Sr., arrived on April 15th to collect his wife and introduce her to the baby she had never seen, healthcare workers in balloons lined the long hospital hallways to watch as she was wheeled outside. They cheered so loudly that you wouldn't have known they were all wearing surgical masks. Oh, my God, I'm so happy, Marshall said. It makes me feel like everything I do is worth it. And there's a picture of her holding her baby in a wheelchair, and the staff all around her commenting to her and talking to her. And I'm going to assume they're smiling, but of course you can't tell with the mask on. The restaurant size tip. Louis Galvin had just wrapped up a takeout order and was clearing off table 411, where a couple of his most loyal customers had finished dinner. Like most restaurants, Irma Southwest was hurting. Located a block from the Houston Astros' Minute Maid Park, Galvin's eatery had just stepped up for the baseball season. More than 30 of his employees were counting on a big opening day that would never come. In the days before the governor closed the state's restaurants, Galvin was especially grateful for regulars such as the ones on table 411. That night they had ordered about $90 worth of food, but it was the tip they left behind that blew him away. Actually, it was two tips. One was $1,000 in cash, or I'm sorry, $1,900 in cash. The other, written on a credit card receipt, was $7,500. The couple also left a handwritten note on the receipt: "Hold to pay your guys over the next few weeks, Ty." He wasn't sure if they were going to stay open, but knowing you have somebody like that, a regular client pulling for you and your staff, "We're going to keep going," said Galvin. He split the money equally among the employees, so everyone got about $300. What's more, Galvin could now pay the tip forward. If there's anyone who does not have food to eat or just needs a glass of water, they are welcome to go by, Galvin says. We are here for our community. Photographic memories. What does American life look like when nobody can leave the house? Photographer Daniel Edmonds and his sister, Tiffany Stoner, aimed to find out. They spent weeks driving their trucks around central Indiana to photograph families on their doorsteps, in their Sunday best or in their pajamas, in the middle of a quarantine. It was hard not to despair, but Edmonds and Stoner saw something inspiring. "Our grandparents remember the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Our parents remember when they were where when JFK was assassinated. We remember the day the Twin Towers collapsed. Our children remember the pandemic that left a global quarantine," Stoner says. What all of these moments have in common is that people became reconnected in the midst of a crisis. Families came together. They loved more. They appreciated more. They found their way back to simplicity and togetherness by tragedy. Nothing glamorous in their pajamas or company clothes, showered or unshowered, holding a newspaper, eating a piece of toast, but holding right to the people they loved the very most. Miles' birthday parade. Miles Halashak was psyched for this sex birthday party. He wanted to dress up as a mad scientist, and his mom was busy making decorations. But about 5 days before the mad scientist Miles was planning to greet 40 friends and relatives at the Halashak's home in Mogador, Ohio. Gee, I grew up in Ohio. I never heard of that town. Social distancing went into effect. "We had bought everything. It was ready to go. And we had to shut it down," his mother Desiree Halashak said, told the Record Courier. Miles was crushed. But his parents had an idea. People might not be able to come into the house to say happy birthday, but they could drive by and do it. The Halashaks put a note on a local Nextdoor.com group asking whether a guest could drop by that Monday, Miles' actual birthday, and simply wave. One wrote back asking for Miles' favorite color, another one to know what candy he liked. On Monday, the first birthday car arrived, honking like crazy. Dozens more joined in, many driven by strangers who had read about Miles' canceled party and wanted to help him celebrate. Some waved birthday signs out their windows. Some had decorated their cars in blue, his favorite color, and threw candy. "I broke down in tears," says Desiree. "I couldn't believe how much love we were getting." To your health. Light Oaks Farm Distillery in New Tripoli, Pennsylvania, was about to close its doors because of the coronavirus crisis. Then its owners realized they could use the grain they would have fermented for bourbon for another valuable commodity, ethanol, the key ingredient in hand sanitizer. Within 2 days, owner Chad Butters had devised a way to use his still to create pure ethanol and began churning out bottles of sanitizers by the thousands. He gave them away to hospitals, assisted living centers, and any neighbors who wanted one. The impromptu switch to sanitizer business also allowed the distillery to keep 25 workers employed. "We love this community," Butters posted on Instagram, "and we love you." And just as an aside, in Durham, there's a company that manufactures high-level and very expensive gin. They also switched to make hand sanitizers, which they gave to hospitals and firemen and paramedics and policemen and such, and they also sell it. Good thing to do. And there's a picture of Chad Butters with his dog standing there. He's wearing a plaid shirt and a brown leather vest and blue jeans. Looks like he's probably in his mid-30s. A higher calling. When Franklin Roosevelt was 16 and away at boarding school, he got sick and was quarantined in the infirmary. His mother was so upset to being kept far from him that she climbed a stepladder outside his window so she could be as close to him as possible. Something similar happened to Charlie Adams, only in reverse. When assisted living facilities nationwide realized they would have to turn visitors away to keep their residents safe, Charlie was worried that he wouldn't be able to visit his 80-year-old mother, Julie Adams. Fortunately, Charlie owns a tree care service in Youngstown, Ohio, which means he has a truck with a large extendable arm, long enough to reach his mother's third-floor window. Her spirits were kind of down because she'd used to being able to get out and go places and do things. "And so I just had the idea that I'd bring the bucket truck over," Charlie says. "I called her and told her I was to come look out the window, and there I was. The men and women at Miami-Dade Fire Rescue had the same high-flying idea. One of the station mates had been in the hospital because of the virus. He was becoming pretty depressed. "It gets so isolating in here," he said in a video later distributed by the department. One morning, a group of Miami-Dade firefighters piled into a truck, drove over to the hospital, and raised the ladder to the unnamed man's fourth-floor room. Standing on the top of the ladder, a firefighter held a handwritten cardboard sign that said, "Your new firehouse. This is love," the hospitalized man said to the video, between obviously labored breaths. "This is the only kind of love you can get from the brother and sisterhood at the firehouse. There's just no other way to explain how this makes me feel." Meet the United in Kindness honorees. In this unusual year, we received hundreds of nominations of people and places that made a difference under the most difficult circumstances. Go to rd.com/nicest in July for detailed stories that honor their efforts. And with that, we're going to switch over to Consumer Reports. And I'm looking at this page. It says Leafy Green Safety Guide, and it's a big picture of a real head of romaine lettuce. In our age of rampant romaine contamination, can our salads be saved? We explain what's at the root of the problem, what critical changes are needed, and what will and won't protect you in the meantime. When Carolyn Graham ordered a garden salad at a pizza restaurant near her hometown in Loomis, California, on a weekday night in April 2018, she felt good about what she thought was a healthy choice. But by the weekend, she had stomach cramps and diarrhea, which grew more severe with each passing hour. By 11 p.m. that Saturday, the diarrhea had turned bloody, and it continued all night long. Around 6 a.m. Sunday, she and her husband, Kenneth, headed to the emergency room. Doctor gave her fluid, oxygen, and antibiotic, but Graham's symptoms didn't abate. It took doctors 3 days of testing and analyzing results to determine that Graham had infected with E. coli 015.H7, a dangerous strain of the bacteria that produces a substance called Shiga toxin. Graham, who was 72 and had been in excellent health, had developed a form of kidney failure called hemolytic uremic syndrome, a side effect that occurs in 5% of people who can contract 015.7H7. Doctors put Graham on dialysis to help her kidneys function properly again, but she was going to in and out of consciousness during her 14-day hospital stay. Her husband, one of her daughters, and a granddaughter stayed by her bedside until she was fully conscious and able to recognize the people around her. Then her husband says she had to relearn how to walk, talk, and a rehab process that took about 2 months before she was back to normal. The culprit in Graham's ordeals? The romaine lettuce in that seemingly innocuous garden salad. That spring, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration sent out multiple national alerts, eventually telling people not to eat romaine from Yuma, Arizona area. Graham, it turned out, was one of 240 people across 37 states in the U.S. that spring who government officials say became sick from tainted romaine. It was the largest national E. coli 015.7H7 outbreak in more than 20 years. Almost half of those affected were hospitalized, and 5 people from 4 states died. Then, right before Thanksgiving the same year, supermarkets and restaurants pulled romaine from their shelves and menu after federal officials announced yet another E. coli outbreak. The return of outbreaks. Just as consumers thought perhaps the 2018 E. coli outbreak were a distant traumatic memory, romaine-related illnesses returned. An outbreak started in October of 2019 and continuing into December, 133 people were sickened. This was despite steps taken over the past 2 years by farmers and the FDA to identify the sources of the outbreaks. Consumer Reports is actively advocating for improved inspection and farming practices to better protect the lettuce food supply. At CR, we're also surveying Americans about their habits and working to debunk myths, including the perception that triple-washed, packaged lettuce is always safe, when in fact, the washing process doesn't remove all the harmful bacteria. It's astonishing how frequently the lettuce-consuming public has been exposed to bacteria like E. coli over the years, says Bill Marler, a food safety lawyer in Seattle, who renegotiated a settlement for Graham. "I have dozens of clients over the years whose lives have been completely upended," he says. "They've needed kidney transplants and had hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical expenses because they chose to eat a presumably healthy food." In fact, between 2006 and 2019, romaine and other leafy greens, such as spinach and bags of spring mix, have been involved in at least 46 multi-state E. coli outbreaks, according to the CDC. Some research shows that greens cause more cases of food poisoning than any other flu, including beef. The constant drumbeat of romaine-related E. coli outbreaks has made Americans very worried about eating lettuce. In a 2019 nationally representative Consumer Reports survey of 1,003 Americans, 52% admitted being concerned about getting sick from leafy greens, more than those who are worried about poisoning from beef, chicken, or eggs. Sales of romaine, which until recently the most popular lettuce in the U.S., are down in the wake of the 2018 outbreaks, dropping about $98 million to $465 million from their $563 million peak in 2017. According from data from market research firm Nielsen, Iceberg has regained the number one spot. Meanwhile, lettuce growers and the FDA have been trying to figure out where, from farm to fork, the potentially deadly bacteria are finding their way into lettuce leaves. Frank Yiannatis, Deputy Commissioner of Food Policy and Response at the FDA and the agency's top food official, told CR, FDA has been working tirelessly to prevent these outbreaks, but we're going to work harder. It's a high priority for the agency and a high priority for me personally. In the meantime, for those who want to continue to eat the healthy benefits of leafy greens, there are safety guidelines that help mitigate the risk. Salad under siege. How did leafy greens, nutrient-packed foods recommended by doctors and nutritionists alike, become so risky? And why is romaine linked to so many of these outbreaks? It comes down to the modern way we grow, harvest, and package our salad greens. There are many opportunities along the continuum from seed all the way to consumer's plate for greens to become contaminated, said Ben Chapman, Ph.D., a professor and food safety extension specialist at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, yay state. Part of the reason greens in particular are so problematic is the sheer volume we're consuming. The leafy greens industry ships about 130 million servings per day all year long, enough to supply daily salad fix for nearly 40% of Americans, and almost a quarter of the greens being consumed are romaine lettuce. Perhaps most important, salad greens are almost always eaten raw. Unlike burgers, eggs, flour, and many other foods that can be contaminated with pathogens, but are usually cooked enough to kill any bacteria. You can destroy E. coli and other bacteria with enough heat, but few people are going to cook their lettuce, says James E. Rogers, Ph.D., Director of Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports. A food that doesn't have a final consumer kill step presents some extra challenges for food safety, says Matthew Wise, Ph.D., Deputy Chief of the CDC's Outbreak Response and Prevention Branch. That's probably the main driver among the number of factors that can cause an outbreak, he says. We face real dilemma with leafy greens, especially romaine lettuce, Rogers says. They're packed with nutrients, so we don't want to discourage people from eating them. But we can't ignore the fact that leafy greens are potentially risky, perhaps one of the riskiest foods. But, he says, we need answers on what's happening with greens sooner rather than later. More needs to be done to determine the exact sources of contamination with dangerous bacteria, he says. Once that's done, the FDA must set strict requirements for growers and processors, which will help prevent people from getting sick. While the odds that you'll get sick from eating any single salad are low, Rogers says they're real. When you hear about 100 or 200 people contracting a foodborne illness, it may not sound like that many, but for every case of food poisoning that's reported, there are many, many more cases that never get reported. In fact, according to the CDC, for every reported case of E. coli 015787 infection, there are probably 26 that have gone undocumented. So how do bacteria get into the greens in the first place? To answer that, it helps to understand the critical water needs of greens and how they are sometimes grown near livestock, both of which can open a pathway to contamination. John Bolts, a farmer in Yuma, owns one of the 60-plus farms that cover a stretch of land from Yuma and the surrounding area to California's Imperial Valley. That's where the vast majority of leafy greens on the market in the U.S. and Canada are harvested in winter. The Yuma growing season begins with the planting of seeds in August in the hot, arid desert. Over the next few months, the dusty brown fields become filled with rows of emerald green heads of romaine, iceberg lettuce, and vegetables, and fruits, Harvesting begins in late October. Lettuce grows best when daytime temperatures are moderate and night times are cool. So as the weather in the human region warms up, lettuce production shifts to California, moving in seasonal increments throughout the southern coast, central coast, Salinas Valley, and parts of Central Valley. Although the soil and environment differ in all these regions, including Yuma, one thing they have in common is they don't get much rain, and green needs lots of water to grow, as much as 36 inches per acre. So all those lettuce leaves require irrigation. At farms around Yuma, which has bolts, water is channeled from the nearby Colorado River through a system of irrigation canals. Once the greens grow to maturity, they're harvested, mostly by hand, Bolts said. Growers take samples of the greens to check for harmful bacteria, but they don't check every leaf, which is why the bacteria sometimes slips through. Some greens are packed right in the field to be immediately cooled and shipped to stores. Greens that are destined to be bagged or sold in plastic containers, 65% of Americans buy packaged greens, according to market research from Mintel, are taken from the field to processing plants, where tons of lettuce from multiple farms are mixed together. Romaine is produced to the tune of 1.5 million tons per year. There, the lettuce is usually washed in water that contains chlorine and another sanitizer, then rinsed, dried, packaged, and shipped to the supermarkets and restaurants across the country. Contamination from cattle. What any lettuce farmer will tell you is that he or she fears the animals that live around lettuce fields. That's because E. coli 015787 and other strains of illness-causing bacteria live in the guts of cattle and other animals, including sheep, deer, wild boar, and even birds. Although the E. coli bacteria don't usually make the animals sick, when they defecate, they deposit dangerous bacteria into the soil and water around them. That contaminated soil could later end up mixed with dirt, tracked by equipment, people, or animals onto a field of leafy greens. Or rain could wash the bacteria into one of the open irrigation canals that are so important to lettuce-growing regions. This route to food processing poisoning has been known about for longer than a decade. In 2006, an E. coli 015787 outbreak linked to spinach, federal officials said that a possible sort was waste from the feral pigs that got into the growing fields. Because animals can contaminate their valuable crops, farmers put a lot of effort into keeping them away. We pay people to stand by the fields and scare the birds off, Boat says. We surround the fields with 8-foot-tall fences prohibiting animals from being on our farms. We're doing everything science says we should, he says. But contamination still occurs, and experts and research say it's because fields of leafy greens are sometimes loaded next door to large cattle farms, known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. It's because of the proximity of cattle feedlots to fresh produce fields, says Keith Warrer, Ph.D., professor in the Department of Food Science at the University of Guelph in Ontario, who has studied foodborne illnesses linked to produce. In the Salinas Valley, you see cattle roaming the hills. Romaine from the Salinas region was linked to outbreaks in the fall of 2018 and the fall of 2019. With every outbreak, there's a cow somewhere, says Attorney Mallor, who has tracked food poisoning incidents limited to greens for almost 20 years. It has also been suspected that bacteria mix with the soil and become part of the dust, which can be carried by the wind from a CAFO deposited into the greens as they grow in the field. But experts and investigators from the FDA and CDC have focused on contaminated irrigation water as the most likely vector. E. coli-tainted manure can run off downhills and into rivers, contaminating water sources, Mariner says. An FDA investigation to identify the source of the contamination in the spring 2018 outbreak that sickened Carolyn Graham never reached a firm conclusion. But investigators strongly suspect an irrigation canal that reportedly provided water to the 36 romaine fields involved in the outbreak. They found the E. coli outbreak strain in 3 samples taken from the canal, which is next to a CAFO that houses more than 100,000 cows. The source for the Thanksgiving 2018 outbreak is still a mystery, but the FDA did find the strain of E. coli that made people sick in sediment from a water reservoir in one of the California farms that grew contaminated lettuce. It's possible that droppings from wild animals tainted the water, but there is also a CAFO near the lettuce farm. These findings suggest that to solve the lettuce problem, we really have to solve the cow problem, says Michael Hanjan, Ph.D., senior scientist at Consumer Reports. Yet even though nearby CAFOs were thought to be the source of the bacteria that caused the outbreaks, Under the law, the FDA wasn't allowed to access those feedlots, and that dead-ended the investigation. The riddle of romaine. The science doesn't clearly show that any leafing green is more or less risky than another, but some researchers suspect that romaine be particularly vulnerable because to contamination because its leaves are so delicate. It can get damaged easily, which makes it easier for the bacteria to get into it, Warner says. In fact, when the romaine involved in a Yuma outbreak was going in the fields, the weather turned cold and windy, possibly injuring the leaves, although other greens have been involved in outbreaks, Warner says. Some, like kale and spinach, are tougher, and they're high in natural antimicrobial compounds called thiocyanates. These greens were irrigated with the same water as the romaine involved in the Yuma Valley outbreak in 2018, but they weren't affected. Also, while other greens are susceptible for these same reasons, they aren't produced in the same quantity, so there's less likely to cause a major outbreak. Then there's the math. We simply eat a lot more romaine than other dark leafy greens. Romaine lettuce remains beloved in the U.S., says Kara Nielsen, a food trend expert in Oakland, California. Despite its drop-off in sales, it's the second most popular salad green, and it's everywhere. Romaine serves as the base for Caesar salads and is often in sandwiches, wraps, and burritos, and it's challenging to find a package of mixed greens that doesn't contain romaine. Problematic packaging. Certain labels proclaim that the greens have been triple-washed. Will that protect you from getting sick? Not necessarily. When bacteria such as E. coli come into contact with any type of lettuce, they're almost impossible to wash off completely, according to CDC and other researchers. That's in part because disease-causing bacteria can get inside the leaves of the greens as they're growing. When contaminated water taken up by the roots is dispersed throughout the plant. What's more, surface bacteria can adhere stubbornly in the wrinkles, grooves, and the leaves. The problem of washing greens in the field or at a processing facility is simply to remove dirt and grit, not bacteria, says C.R.'s Rogers. According to C.R.'s own recent lettuce test, washed and bagged lettuce isn't any cleaner, bacteria-wise, than whole heads of lettuce. Furthermore, packages with triple-washed or similar claim on the label contained amounts of bacteria similar to those in the packages that direct people to wash before eating. Although the washing process for packaged greens can move up to 99% of the bacteria, as it's removing dirt and grit, food safety expert Chapman says even small amounts that remain may make you sick. Shiga toxin producing E. coli has a very low infectious dose. As little as 10 microscopic cells is all it takes, according to some estimates, says Rogers. And greens destined for packaging carry unique risk. A Baxter box of green often contains leaves from many different farms that have been mixed together at a processing plant, says C.R. Hansen. And because the leaves may be cut or shredded, the bacteria have more entry points. So if there is even a small amount of bacteria carrying lettuce in the batch from just one farm, it can contaminate many, many packages of greens, he says. In fact, in 2006 spinach outbreak, the tainted greens were eventually traced to one small section of just one grower's field. In addition, cut or damaged leaves secrete juices that feed bacteria. They are present, and the juices can collect in the packages. A need for more inspection. The challenge, then, is figuring out which steps will decrease the risk of contracting food poisoning, says Rogers. He says making salads safer will require close attention by growers and regulators at every step of leafy green production. Unless something changes in the way greens are grown and processed, outbreaks will continue to happen, he says. People within the industry are making ongoing efforts to improve the situation. We are doing everything we can as an industry, says Scott Horshaw, CEO of the California Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement. It's a very important and efficient system for the most part, but we are very focused on eliminating the illnesses that do occur. Upwards of 97% of leafy green growers in Arizona and California now follow the standards set by the LGMA, which includes mandatory inspections to ensure they're following standards, though the results of these audits are not public. LGMA standards put in place by the Arizona and California LGMAs after 2018 require that if water is going to be used for irrigation in the 21 days before harvest, it needs to be tested at least once and treated if bacteria are found. The minimum buffer zone for CAFOs and fields of leafy greens has tripled, from 400 feet to 1,200 feet, based on research indicating that E. coli could travel 600 feet. Fields in California must be at least a mile from larger CAFOs. Some growers, like Boer, say they're even further, ensuring that no irrigation water touches edible portion of any plant, not any planting within 2 miles of animal farms. But even these safeguards may not be sufficient, according to experts such as Warner of the University of Gulf. The FDA, the leafy green industry, and the researchers at the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension are conducting a multi-year study to better understand all the ways that produce may be contaminated. We're collecting thousands of samples over the course of a few years, soil samples, water samples, air samples, animal footprints, to see if it can further inform what we know about the contamination might occur. And we're hopeful that it will, says FDA's Yiannonis. But we never get to a place where lettuce is considered a low-risk food. Producers have always made most of the changes that we know would improve food safety, so the next steps are going to be harder to uncover, according to Channel Rock, Ph.D., one researcher on the project. There's no such thing as zero risk, she says. Getting to the root source. We know it's a complicated problem, says C.R. Rogers, but this system is broken, and there are things that could be done that aren't being done. Although members of the LGMA test and now treat surface water that touches edible plants, parts of plants, at least once in the 21 days before each harvest, according to the organizational standards, CR thinks more testing is needed. The FDA needs to implement the stricter water testing rules that were laid on the Food Safety Modernization Act, says CR Hansen. Those rules, which require more testing of more water samples, were supposed to take an effect in 2018, but they have yet to be implemented or are now pushed out to at least 2022. The delay is unacceptable, he says. And under the SFMA, the FDA is supposed to issue a list of high-risk foods, defines of those that are often involved in food poisoning outbreaks or produced in a way that makes them more likely to contain dangerous bacteria, but has not yet done so. The FDA should immediately develop this list and put leafy greens on it, Rogers says. By law, once this food is deemed high-risk, the FDA has more authority to require record-keeping and compel recalls, he says. That will go a long way toward preventing or controlling foodborne illness. CR experts also say that Congress should pass legislation recently proposed for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat, New York, and Representative Rosa L. DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, that aims to strengthen the FDA's ability to pinpoint the origin of foodborne illness outbreaks in greens and other produce. The legislation, if passed, would do this by giving FDA the power to inspect CAFOs to look for bacteria that could be infecting the lettuce, something it's not legally able to do right now. Being able to trace the origin of the dangerous bacteria is key to halting foodborne outbreaks, says C.R. Rogers. After the 2018 outbreaks, the FDA requested that romaine lettuce producers voluntarily list the region of origin on their packaging, and many did. The theory is that if this lettuce is labeled and an outbreak occurs, retailers will know exactly what to pull from their shelves, and consumers will be able to check labels before buying or eating greens. This kind of labeling is a step in the right direction. It should be made mandatory, Rogers says, but it relies on the shopper knowing first that there's been an outbreak and then remembering which part of the U.S. is involved and then checking the label for information. That's a lot to ask of consumers. People also need to be alerted to food poisoning outbreaks and recalls more quickly, Rogers says. When the FDA knew of a possible outbreak in E. coli linked to romaine in September 2019, the agency waited 6 weeks after beginning its investigation before revealing to the public that there was a problem. I think it's immoral not to tell the public about contamination as soon as it's known, says food safety attorney Marler. It undermines the public health agency's credibility. Why the delay? The FDA says by the time they were made aware of the outbreak, that lettuce was past its expiration date and was no longer on store shelves, so it believed there would be no new illnesses. But, says C.R. Hansen, given the continuing problems with romaine and the series of 01578 same, the FDA should have made an announcement sooner and let consumers decide for themselves whether they wanted to continue to eat romaine. And then we have a graphic about how greens become contaminated, and I'll try to describe it to you. Harmful bacteria can migrate to leaves at many points during the growing production cycle. And there's a picture here of a farm with leaves and irrigation, with an irrigation canal, wild animals, and cattle nearby. A. The toxic E. coli is found in the feces of farm animals such as cattle and sheep. Bacteria from the waste of animals housed in nearby food lands contaminate the water used to irrigate the field, or it can be carried by the wind and deposited on the soil or greens. The bacteria can be taken up by the plant's roots as the greens grow. This means the bacteria can get into the plant's leaves. Wild animals or birds flying overhead, I didn't know wild animals could fly, overhead, can also deposit the bacteria in the fields. I'm sorry, but that wording is kind of weird. Number two, when they're harvested, and there's a picture of machines and individuals doing harvest work. A, farming equipment that travels over contaminated soil may carry bacteria into the field. So one field might not be even contaminated, but the next one that they run the machine in is. Bacteria may be transferred to the greens by workers' hands or gloves, by contaminated harvesting equipment such as knives, or in the storage bins. Harvesting greens involves cutting them, and the cut ends of lettuce secrete nutrients and liquids that can support the growth of bacteria. This can also happen if the leaves are bruised or damaged. And number three, at the processing plant. And there's a picture here of the stuff being unloaded, running through the processing plant, and then being washed, and then being put into trucks. A, greens from many fields and farms are mixed together during processing, meaning that one bacteria-containing batch, or even a few leaves, can end up contaminating many packages of lettuce or greens. The factory workers who don't wash their hands and equipment that hasn't been properly sanitized prevent threats. Greens may be washed in a sanitizing solution, but if water is recycled, it increases the chances of cross-contamination. Greens may be cut or chopped, which provides an opportunity for bacteria to enter the leaves. So there's multiple chances. How to shop the lettuce labels? This is interesting. Well, first of all, let me go to talk about the health benefits of leafy greens. Then we'll come back to this one. Given the concerns about contamination, you may be tempted to cut greens out of your diet, but that would be a shame. Nutritionists agree that the benefits are substantial. Research shows that they're linked to a reduced risk of heart disease and certain cancers, macular degeneration, and type 2 diabetes. They may also help keep memory sharp as a person ages. Most greens have a healthy and nutritional profile, but each kind also has its individual superpowers, which is why it's good to eat a variety. Arugula. Arugula is rich in vitamin K, which helps to prevent osteoporosis and inflammatory disease. Like other cruciferous veggies, broccoli and Brussels sprouts, it has glucosinolates, which may protect against certain cancer. It's tasty in salads or sautéed. Butter, a.k.a. Boston or bib lettuce. This family of mild-flavored head lettuce with the soft, loose leaves doesn't have quite the nutrient profile of certain darker greens, but 2 cups supplies 85% of your daily vitamin K need, along with some iron and vitamin A. Collards, and here in the South we know those. This cooking green is rich in calcium, fiber, folate, and antioxidant, carotenoids, beta-carotene, and lutein. Sautéing in olive oil, garlic, and a little smoked salt adds flavor and keeps it healthier than the traditional hammock or bacon preparation. Red or green leaf? Both are rich in vitamins A and K. Green leaf is higher in vitamin C. Red leaf lettuce gets its color from the flavonoid antioxidant anthocyanin, which may help lower levels of LDA, bad cholesterol. Kale. Turn to kale for vitamins C and K, lutein, and zeaxanthin, which may help protect against age-related macular degeneration and possibly cataracts, and cancer-fighting glucosinolates. Use baby and mature kale in salads. The latter can also be cooked in soup or pasta. Iceberg. Though it ranks toward the bottom of the greens list nutritionally, it still provides some potassium, vitamin C, and folate. Romaine, beta-carotene, which your body converts to vitamin A, and folate, and its standout nutrients, is best in salads or on sandwiches that need crunch, and could also stand up to a quick grilling. Spinach, this green supplies a hefty dose of vitamin K, potassium, and folate. If you eat it cooked, it will also supply iron and calcium. The oxalic acid contains reduces absorption of these minerals from raw spinach, but cooking breaks down the oxalic acid. And Swiss chard. A cooked cup of this strongly flavored green gives you all the vitamin K that you need per day, plus vitamins A and C and antioxidant carotenoids and flavonoids. Toss into egg dishes or soups and saute with garlic and toss with sesame seeds or lemon juice. Finding from CR's lettuce testing. In spring 2019, CR's food safety scientists tested 283 samples of bagged and whole heads of six types of leafy greens, including romaine, spinach, and kale, plus mixes of greens. While we didn't find the dangerous E. coli O157H7 implicated in recent romaine lettuce outbreaks, we did find that certain samples contain coliform bacteria. This type of bacteria doesn't make people sick, but it's a sign that feces may have come into contact with the lettuce, and when we see it, it's considered a harbinger of possible contamination with harmful bacteria, says James E. Rogers, Ph.D., Director of Food Safety and Research and Testing at Consumer Reports. There was no difference in bacteria levels between whole head and packaged greens. Packaged greens that were labeled triple washed had bacteria levels similar to those in packages marked unwashed. More worrisome, we also found Listeria monocytogenes, dangerous bacteria found in the environment, in six of the samples, two bagged and four loose heads. CR immediately informed the FDA, the CDC, and companies one of the samples had a strain genetically linked to at least two cases of Listeriosis, the illness caused by Listeria, reported to the CDC. Listeriosis is rare, but kills about 20% of those affected, compared with less percent of E. coli, Campylobacteria, and Salmonella. And we've just about run out of time. I have several more things that I'll bring up next week when we read about the difference, how to shop the lettuce labels, the difference in how risky are greens versus other foods, and the safest way to eat a salad. So those are all important things, and we'll do them next week. And last week, we finished up with a little bit of word power from the second half of the alphabet. So let's do a couple of those. Punt, P-U-N-T. And punt is a flat-bottom boat. The travelers steered their punt down the Thames. And torturous. Is it chumpy, winding, or painful? Torturous is a winding. The trail is torturous and steep, but the reward is a spectacular view from the summit. Onyx, is that an antelope, a gemstone, or a primrose? It's a gemstone. Harold gave Esme a black onyx ring for her birthday. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.